Book those tickets to Saudi. It's time for another Flat Chat. And the latest issue of GP Racing is on the shelves today. Landed on my doorstep 20 minutes ago. And it's the season preview issue, no less. It's been slightly longer than usual between editions owing to, well, there's a pandemic going on, I'm told, and that's affected the Formula One calendar. This not to go too Alan Partridge this early in the podcast. But yeah, we've had to shift our schedule. This issue's a bit later in order for us to offer you pictures of actual Formula One cars rather than graphical renderings, all down to the start of the season, shifting back a couple of weeks. So thanks to all you subscribers for your patience, and no thanks at all to Formula One for not releasing details of the new Jeddah street circuit until 3 days after we went to press. Yabu and sucks to you lot. Anyhow, there's a pretty spicy Formula One season just around the corner. Joining us to look forward to it, our regular cast, and first up live from the vineyards of South Australia, it's time for that great galah, Mark Gallagher.
Good to be back talking to you. I'm so disappointed you missed out on that press release from Jeddah about there. What are they claiming it to be? The fastest ever Formula One street circuit.
Do you know how pandas don't like to meet other pandas when they're out in the forest? So what they do, just to tell other pandas to get out of their territory, they mark their territory on trees. And pandas, in order to urinate much higher up a tree than might otherwise be possible, just in order to say, I'm a really big panda, don't come in my thing, they actually stand on their hands in order to mark their territory up the tree. So say, yeah, huge panda here, don't come in. This is what's going on with this press release. It's like, take this, Baku, we're the fastest street circuit in town now. Anyway, hello from southern England to Ben Anderson.
Hello, wow. I wasn't expecting to be talking about pandas.
Sorry, that was a colossal digression, wasn't it?
Really? Yeah, I must apologise to regular listeners enjoying the gravelly voice that I possess. But one of the unfortunate things about having a two-year-old in the house is that they bring horrible non-COVID viruses back home with them from nurseries, and he's managed to wipe out the entire household for the past week or so.
Nurseries are basically toxic brewing houses for illnesses, aren't they?
Yeah, I guess they mark their territory with snot and saliva rather than by standing on their hands.
They probably stand on their hands while they're doing that as well, I should imagine.
Yeah, possibly, yeah. They're very talented young children, certainly at getting sick and making me feel worse. But yes, I'll do my best. I'll just let you guys do most of the talking.
Brilliant. We've got a massive, it says on the cover, 132 pages. No wonder it took so long to make. And we've covered pretty much every angle of what's different, what there is to look forward to this year over the course of four cleverly themed chapters. And given that this was supposed to be kind of an interim year when there wasn't really very much going on, there's actually quite a lot happening. And I suppose perhaps the most exciting vibes coming from testing is that Red Bull might actually be strong out of the blocks this year for the first time in yonks, while Mercedes seems to be in trouble. So what do we actually think about that? Because, you know, we've been here before with Mercedes that, oh, we're in trouble here, let's have a comedy debrief afterwards and talk about ducks and horses and hope everyone starts placing bets on Red Bull rather than us. It seems a bit smoke and mirrors as opposed to ducks and horses.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? It almost feels like maybe instead of Red Bull, you know, Red Bull typically start the season a little bit slowly and then play catch up and finish strongly, as indeed they did last year. But maybe this is the second half of a two-part season to them. Maybe that's just, it's carried through. They've carried that momentum. I also wonder about the extent to which the Honda decision to pull out of Formula One and then Red Bull's decision to invest in the engine program means that they've been incredibly busy over the winter perfecting the package in perhaps ways that they didn't maybe previously have the opportunity to do. Now, I'm not saying this from any perspective of inside knowledge, obviously, but just thinking about the mechanism by which Red Bull will have already begun to take over learning how the whole Honda operation works and the way that will have been integrated. There was just such a sense of optimism before they went to the test. And then the test kind of, they stamped their authority in quite an emphatic way. So based on the fact that so many people thought it was going to be more of the same this year. We came away from the Bahrain test thinking, actually, things seem to have shaken up a little bit, and it's very encouraging. I mean, let's hope it's the case, because wouldn't it be wonderful if Red Bull did start the season on a high?
When we were conceiving this season preview issue, actually, the prospect of a Mercedes-Red Bull, a proper fight at last for the championship, wasn't top of the list of things to look out for. It was certainly on there, because, you know, they're definitely the most likely challenger based on recent form. But there's a lot else going on in terms of drivers swapping seats and teams changing identity. Red Bull were wrapped up in that in terms of, like you said, Mark, taking on the Honda engine program, turning it into their own, setting up a whole new department. Red Bull Powertrains, I did a media briefing with Christian Horner talking about that earlier in the winter. Very exciting chapter. That's Red Bull putting themselves really on the same platform as their major rivals, Mercedes and Ferrari, you know, finally being a properly integrated works team, if you like. Although, obviously, they won't be doing a brand new engine for a good few years yet, and they may yet partner with somebody to do that. So there's a lot of exciting things going on at Milton Keynes. They're very busy. Christian said that had been taking up a lot of his time. You get the sense that, like you said, it is perhaps part two, the sequel to last season. Obviously, the big thing in Red Bull's favour compared to recent seasons is the carryover from 1 year to the next on the cars, the chassis specs being largely frozen. Obviously, there are certain things that can be changed. Aerodynamics are not restricted, only by some tweaks to the regulations in terms of floor size and etc. Stuart, you wrote a very detailed and interesting chapter all about that, which explains what to look out for on the cars from a design point of view this year. That will have an effect, obviously, on performance. It seems that maybe Red Bull have understood the effects of that very well. Maybe Mercedes have engineered in a few traps that they need to disarm. Normally they're so good at that. So I'd be wary of reading too much into testing, only because, you know, Mercedes stopped developing last year's car very early. I think it was race 7 the last time they updated, I remember reading. So they've had a lot of time to think about these small tweaks to the rules for 21 and how that might affect the platform. Red Bull were developing much later into the season because they introduced problems on last year's car. So it feels like maybe they're starting with a package that's a lot more familiar to them. They even called the 2021 car the RB16B. It's a genuine B spec, whereas Mercedes have done a new denomination, if you like, the W12. So maybe Red Bull just have something that's a bit more familiar, a bit better understood. There's a bit more of a seamless transition from last year to this year. It feels also like they're really going for it this year, with Honda pulling out after this season. It feels like it's the kitchen sink time, going for the world title, trying to make sure they sign off that partnership with the ultimate prize. It's a good chance to go for it, because at the same time the rules have restricted everyone for cost reasons, and it means that you can't change too much to the cars. Equally, that gives Mercedes, even though they've bought themselves a lot of time by stopping development early last year, there isn't so much room for them to find new innovations and ideas to stretch further away again. So there's perhaps a unique opportunity before the massive rules reset that's been delayed for 2022 for the whole field to converge this year. And actually, we might start the season with a full-blown battle between the top two teams. Given Red Bull finished last season with marginally the quicker car, maybe. Certainly they were bang on the pace for the last two or three rounds. Obviously Max Verstappen won in Abu Dhabi, which is a track Mercedes has dominated on in the hybrid era. That bodes really well if the general competitive picture, mitigating all these minor rule tweaks, is broadly similar to what we saw at the end of last year. So they should be able to go at it from race one, which would be really exciting.
You made a very good point there about the fact that Honda are throwing the kitchen sink at what is their final year, because this time around Honda would quite like to win the championship the year before they leave the world championship as opposed to the year after, when, you know, someone else runs the program that they spent all their money on. So it's and that would be a great result. And I think that, you know, despite the criticism, which I think is deserved, of the fact that Honda have this, you know, we've talked about it before, you know, half in, half out approach to Formula One, and you kind of feel, you know, they'll probably be back again, won't they? Probably pitch up in 2028, 3 years after the synthetic fuel regulations start, and try and play patch up all over again, then withdraw in 2030 again. So it's a, but, you know, despite that criticism, there's no doubt that Honda over the years have contributed so much to Formula One. And if it is going to be a perfect swan song for them, if they're going to have a proper championship challenger this year, that's going to be a great way for them to bow out. And also, it'll be a great way for Red Bull to take on board that engine program going into 2022, knowing that Honda have given them absolutely everything they possibly could in that final year prior to the engine freeze. So it's, you know, it's encouraging. I'm intrigued to know what Sergio Perez now feels about his opportunity, because on the scale of be careful what you wish for, you know, ending up in that Red Bull Honda up against Max, he'll now have an appreciation of Max, of his position in the team, of the way the team is constructed around Max as the historically the lead driver. Yeah, it's been very interesting. I mean, he looks like he's bouncing on the you know, the balls of his feet, delighted to be there, and why shouldn't he be? But this is going to be a big challenge for Sergio Perez. Let's hope he rises to it.
They've now eliminated, or they think they've eliminated, the rear end and stability, which is kind of been the built-in excuse for the second driver in that team for a few years now, hasn't it? It's been a case of, well, Max can live with that. He thrives on it, but, you know, poor silence number two can't quite manage it. And it's been the career death of several Red Bull junior drivers, which is, amusingly enough, why Sergio Perez has got his shot. And it was interesting that this past week there's been this revelation from Sergio that he was basically evaluated and rejected by Red Bull about 15 years ago, and that Helmut Marko thought he was rubbish.
It just shows how things change over time, though, doesn't it? I mean, no, the Perez of then is very different to the Perez of now. The Perez of the following season, as Sergio pointed out, was very different to the one that Marko saw. It's always a challenge when you only get a tiny window in which to view someone and their ultimate potential. I mean, Perez was very impressive in British Formula 3 in 2008 without Red Bull's support. Obviously, he had the Telmex programme behind him, and that powered him into Formula 1. He did very well, and the McLaren opportunity came a bit too soon, I think. And he, in the way, I think he's been quite fortunate to land at Red Bull at probably the perfect time. If you're going to drop in for one season, you're coming into a year where Red Bull is absolutely laser focused on winning this world championship. Honda's brought forward their engine developments that were originally planned for 22 to get them in the car before they bow out. Obviously, that might introduce some problems as things are wound up. We haven't necessarily seen everything that everyone can do. Obviously, the conditions in Bahrain were very difficult as well in the test, so we want to be wary of reading too much into it. But the starting point seems very strong. Red Bull were very strong at the end of last year. Honda sorted out their reliability. The performance was pretty good. They've brought a lot more to the table for this year. Perez is slotting in, and it couldn't really be a better opportunity for a guy at that stage of his career. If you compare to McLaren, obviously he joined McLaren for 2013, and they were just at the beginning of a downward spiral that's taken them, well, until now, and they're still going to get out of. So I think it's a two-sided coin. I mean, Christian Horner, when I spoke to him, he said, you know, the main reason for Red Bull signing Perez is that, you know, he was on the market uniquely. He really should still be in the Aston Martin team, what was Racing Point. He was driving well enough. He finished fourth in the World Championship. He won a race. You know, he should still be in that team, really. Especially given the extra lengths he went to and the role he played in saving that team from, you know, administration in the first, well, he put it into administration, but saving it from the financial difficulties it was having under Vijay Mallya's ownership in the later years. So for him to be kind of unceremoniously ditched so that they could get Vettel in, bit of a kick in the teeth for Perez, considering how well he's been performing. So Red Bull are getting their hands on a driver who is kind of, I guess, at the peak of his powers. Once was considered as someone who could race in a top team, got that opportunity too soon, didn't work out, has rebuilt himself. He's been one of the midfield's best, most consistent performers for a long time. So at the bare minimum, Red Bull are going to get a driver who knows how to score the points a car can deliver on any given weekend. And really, that's what they need if they want to win the Constructors' Championship, because the biggest weakness for them, other than the engineering problems they've had with the car periodically over the last few years, is not having a driver who can get in amongst the Mercedes cars and make Mercedes' life more difficult and help Max when he's got a chance of maybe beating Lewis Hamilton to a race win, give Red Bull the strategic options they need and also the points they need. You know, for Perez to finish fourth in the championship last year in a racing point, that's where Albon should have been. It's where Gasly should have been when he had the chance. And I accept those cars were maybe more difficult to drive and those guys had less experience. So in terms of understanding what they needed to do, maybe it wasn't there yet. But, you know, that's the cutthroat world of the top part of Formula One, isn't it? You need to be in there and at the bare minimum achieving the lowest expected result of that car on every race weekend. And unfortunately, those two weren't doing it. So while the Red Bull Junior program rebuilds and new talent feeds through, obviously Yuki Tsunoda at AlphaTauri looks like the next big thing. I know it seems like a bit of a sop to Honda, but Helmut Marko's genuinely excited about this kid. He's going to take some time to bed in, so the stars have aligned and Perez gets his big break at last.
Gosh, Helmut Marko didn't really rate Sergio Perez, but he thinks Tsunoda is amazing. So, I mean, I think Sergio should remember that not long before Helmut decided he wasn't very good, he also decided that Enrico Bernoldi was a better bet than Kimi Raikkonen, which is why they then fell out with Peter Sauber, who said no, I want to have Raikkonen in the car. So, but it's going to be fascinating. My kind of gut expectation of Red Bull this year is that Max is going to be absolutely nailing it, going for those front row slots, poles, going for the victories. What's going to be really interesting is to see Sergio playing the beautiful game that he does in a race, where he looks after the car, the tyres, maintains that performance and doesn't have the rough edges that sometimes we can see from Max. And when I say the rough edges, I don't necessarily mean from Max's driving. I'm talking a little bit more about his temperament. And I think Sergio has a nice temperament and he will have that. He'll be kind of stalking along and you can just imagine that there'll be a race where Max will be going for glory and it'll all go pear-shaped and Sergio will take the victory. And let's hope it happens, because it would be great to see a Sergio Perez take an early victory the first four or six Grand Prix of the season, you know, get his name on the winner's board. I think that would be great for the team, excellent for him in terms of the step up that he's been given this year. And certainly to your point, Ben, it's what Red Bull need. They don't need a one car wonder team with Max Verstappen anymore to beat Mercedes-Benz. They need both drivers giving it everything all the time. And for the dynamic and the consistency to somehow between Verstappen and Perez to be better than between Hamilton and Bottas. And that's not to say that's not to go down the rabbit hole of criticism of Valtteri Bottas, because I think he is a very fine driver. But I know you're starting to laugh at that. But anyway, he's a very fine driver and he has rebuilt himself for the fourth winter that he's rebuilt himself. Anyway,
we've lost count now.
He goes through more updates than Zwift.
But anyway, this is going to be the really interesting dynamic, you know, two drivers against two drivers, two cars against two cars, and that's of course to discount everyone else, which I don't think we should do. I think there will be opportunities for other people to creep in the mix.
You also wonder if Sergio, being sort of a little bit older, a little bit more experienced than some of the other denizens of that seat recently, will take a more pragmatic view if things don't go his way. Because, you know, obviously Alex Albon sort of was very up and down. Sometimes it worked for him, sometimes it didn't. Pierre Gasly obviously left such a bad impression that they're not considering re-employing him, even as a Grand Prix winner now. And it takes me back to an evening at a pizzeria on the Belgian-German border. A group of us were having dinner one night and a Red Bull mechanic came in to get a substantial takeout order. And he told us all about what had gone on the first 6 months of that year and how many changes of seat fitting and pedal angle and things like that they'd gone through, because Pierre thought that his problems came from him not sitting right. And he thought if he just adjusted his seat angle a little bit or changed the pedal box, then it would all happen. And he thought that was the problem rather than a fundamental element of the car, or the way he was kind of overdriving it and trying to chase performance, you sort of think that someone who's been around the block as many times as Sergio Perez has won't disappear, if I can use the rabbit hole metaphor again, disappear down that rabbit hole.
Well, exactly, yeah. I think that's the key. He should have a calmer, broader view of how things are going and not overreact when things don't go your way. I think, you know, Gasly was in a difficult moment because he perhaps had the focus in slightly the wrong place, as you describe, and then once you have a run of bad results, it's very difficult to take a step back when you're young and you're trying to prove yourself and go against that grain. I think with Alex Albon, it would have been interesting to see how his season had unfolded had a couple of his early races gone a bit better and some of his decisions, brave decisions, come off. I mean, you know, he was a tap from Lewis Hamilton away from potentially winning one of the early races of the season at the Red Bull Ring. You know, had he been able to win his second Grand Prix with the team, it was the first one, wasn't it, that I think Mercedes had the gearbox problems. So, you know, had Alex won the first race of the season, his first race with Red Bull, maybe his whole attitude, his whole feeling, his confidence, everything else, his whole outlook would have been different. And then maybe he would have been able to be more consistent. It would have taken the pressure off him. These things can have a dramatic influence, and certainly a more dramatic influence on drivers who haven't got the experience and have maybe a bit more to prove. Whereas in Sergio's case, like you said, Collins, he's been around the block. You know, he's got a huge wealth of experience now. He's quicker than people think as well. You know, his time alongside Nico Hülkenberg, who was once, you know, fated as the next big thing after, you know, demolishing the junior series and getting that amazing pole for Williams in Brazil in 2010. You know, Hülkenberg, a very, very quick driver who didn't quite get the big break that he almost was expected to get. You know, Perez was nip and tuck with him when they were Force India teammates. So, you know, Perez is fast, experienced, calm now. As long as he doesn't collide with Max, I think he'll be able to keep his cool. So that should mean, you know, he said he needs 5 races really to get up to speed. I mean, that's a sensible approach already, trying to take the pressure off a bit to say, okay, I know this car is good. Obviously, if Red Bull have hit the ground running and the package is performing really well from the first test, then that will make Perez's job easier and actually has a better chance, especially if Mercedes are struggling genuinely to get big results in the early races. But he's already, you know, got a clear plan in his mind of, you know, not to expect too much too soon, to build up through the early races, get an understanding of how the car performs in different conditions on different circuits, and then try to put that all into practice to kick on for the remainder of the season. And it's a mature approach, especially considering he's on a 1-year ticket. You know, he's not, it's not like Red Bull have signed him up for 3 years and they're, you know, they're building around this Max Perez driver partnership for the long term. You know, he's in for this 1 year, let's throw everything at trying to win both championships. So it's a high pressure environment to go into, but also it's the career opportunity of a lifetime for a driver who was otherwise going to be out on his ear this year.
Well, he's also, on that note, to my mind, dodged a bullet in no longer being part of the Aston Martin picture, or Aston Martin, as its new owner randomly calls it.
Has he renamed it?
Lawrence Stroll's pronunciation of Aston Martin is one of the most disconcerting things I've witnessed this year, alongside with possibly the question of the year in the online launch, which Sergio will be pleased he dodged, because never has a more penetrating question been asked of a Formula One driver than, which do you prefer, dogs or cats? So shall we turn our attention to this absolute madness? Because another of the big themes of this season is the amount of change in the midfield. Complete change of identity for two teams. Based on the test, the competitive picture in that midfield is a bit murky. But both Alpine and Aston Martin showed their ambition with some fairly grandiose online launches during launch week. Although the tech and the script let them down on both occasions, you might say. So, what did we think, guys? Apart from, you know, the strange Hollywood actress channeling Sam Fox and Mick Fleetwood at the 1989 Brit Awards during the Aston Martin launch.
Well, the Alpine launch, I could barely watch because it was so glitched.
Yes, it was glitchy, wasn't it?
Yeah, my screen was giving me a headache. I have mixed feelings because on the one hand, I like the fact that, especially with the extra time that the calendar shift afforded the teams, you know, they all made an effort to do a presentation, to do a proper launch. You know, for a long time we've bemoaned the hasty rollout on the crisp Barcelona morning in the pit lane. The covers come off, the drivers stand there, quick picture, and then off you go. Doesn't really count as a car launch, does it? Even though it's very practical. So it's kind of nice to see a bit of razzmatazz to varying degrees. But at the same time, you know, the substance of this is not a huge amount of difference. You know, the Aston Martin takeover is really just a merging of the two things that Lawrence Stroll has bought and a new paint job for the car. You know, this is still the pink Mercedes of last year, but in green. And the fundamental basis of that outfit is this close customer relationship with Mercedes, and obviously the signing of Sebastian Vettel to replace Sergio Perez, which is open to question, I think, genuinely, whether that's a performance gain. If you paired Vettel alongside Perez, you might say that was a genuine driver lineup upgrade, but Lance Stroll's pole in Turkey aside, which was a great performance, and he's had a few of them in his career so far, I don't think really he was at the same level as Perez throughout last season. So the Stroll-Vettel combination is a questionable one in the sense that, you know, Lance hasn't consistently shown enough, I don't think, to warrant genuinely a works team, in inverted commas, seat. But obviously there are unique reasons why he's at that outfit. And Vettel is obviously coming off the back of one of his worst seasons ever. He's had a very difficult spell with Ferrari, so are you getting the Vettel that won 4 world championships with Red Bull? It's open to question. Maybe this new environment, historically, Racing Point, Force India, have been very good at focusing on their drivers and getting the most out of them. They helped Perez, obviously, after his terrible experience at McLaren, rebuild and become a driver that Red Bull thought was now worth sticking in their Formula One car rather than binning off at the Formula BMW stage. So maybe, given it's the same group of people at the core, they can do a similar job with Vettel. I mean, I'm not saying Vettel is quite as on the floor as maybe Perez was, and it's slightly different when you've got a guy who's won that many championships, but certainly Vettel needs to rediscover some of the old magic. So it could be a tricky season for that team. You know, they've got perhaps one of the best packages technically in the midfield, a strong car, very good engine, good support from Mercedes, but it felt like after many years of making the most of not a lot as Force India and Racing Point, last year they had a car that could have finished third in the championship and they kind of squandered it. They didn't really get the results that it felt like that package deserved, and it could be a similar story this year if Stroll isn't more consistent and also Vettel takes too long to kind of get up to speed, rediscover his, I mean, he says mojo doesn't exist in German, but mojo. And also
the Germans don't have a word for Schadenfreude either.
But, you know, and he had a difficult test as well. You know, he didn't get the laps that he wanted. So, you know, he's starting on the back foot anyway. So I think there's a lot of excitement around the Aston Martin theme because it's a famous name and, you know, it looks cool, but it's important to remember that really this is about 2022 and beyond, I think, for that team, and they need the revolution to come in Formula One to really for that whole project to make sense. I think this year it could be very difficult for them when you consider the steps that some of their close midfield competitors have taken. You know, McLaren taking customer Mercedes engines, I think that will make a big difference to a team that's already very much on the up. I think they're probably the favourites for me in the midfield, and I wouldn't mind betting that Daniel Ricciardo could certainly be on the podium a few times and maybe win a race if Mercedes and Red Bull implode. And obviously Ferrari, you know, they're coming from a terrible basis. You know, their worst season since 1980, but there were very clear reasons for that. You know, the engine had to be a lot less powerful than they were expecting after that late arrangement with the FIA on the eve of last season. They designed the whole chassis around engine output that they then didn't have. So it was draggy, as well as not handling very well. You know, they're bits of low-hanging fruit that Maranello's been able to grab, and it already looks like, you know, they'll take a step forward. They've pledged they won't develop much through the year, because they're banking on basically they're going to be good enough to finish third just from correcting those major flaws. And obviously, they're, you know, despite being chaotic periodically, historically, you know, we know they're a strong operation, and they will do better than last year. So it makes the job of Alpine, Aston Martin, right. Or Aston Martin, depending on however you want to pronounce it. You know, I think they face stiffer competition than they did last year.
Well, I'm pleased to see the two of you, and I've not fallen into the trap of lots of other media who are obviously angling to get an Aston Martin fleet car to drive to Monza.
I drive a Skoda, I don't need one.
Or Spa. I mean, for what it's worth, I have to say, I think under Lawrence Stroll's enlightened leadership of Aston Martin, with a very fine car like an Aston Martin Vantage, it would make a beautiful machine to drive to Monza in. And you know,
I'm sure Vettel will agree when he gets his company car.
Absolutely, and I wouldn't even mind if it had a twitchy rear end. But seems to be a theme this past couple of years, in the twitchy rear ends. Anyway, all the points you made, Ben, spot on as usual. The level of competition is so high. Aston Martin and Alpine have got a massive task on their hands to finish in the top three in the championship, either of them. For Aston Martin to finish in the top three in the championship, they have to do something that team at Silverstone hasn't done in over 20 years. And when it did happen in the Jordan days in 1999, sorry to my former colleagues, but one of the reasons was the fundamental weakness of some of the other teams that were going through difficult periods. So, as you say, Ben, Ferrari are going to stage a recovery. Third place in the championship is the minimum target for them. It'll be regarded as a disastrous season for Ferrari if they finish fourth, fifth or sixth in the championship. If they finish sixth, I think half of them may as well go down the job centre, quite frankly, because of the reaction that there will be. But the, you know, top three in the championship is what they'll be looking for. Ferrari will be the ones looking to pick up a win if Mercedes and Red Bull trip up. That's where they're going to be at. I agree with you. I think last year we spent all year talking about the pink Mercedes. If it was a pink Mercedes, the team didn't extract consistent enough performance from it for it to merit all the hoo-ha over it. I mean, quite frankly, if they'd gone out and won four Grand Prix, I could have seen, you know, the scandal being worth it. But as it was, yes, they scored a victory, but
they flattered to deceive, didn't they?
Flattered to deceive. And the new paint job and rebranding is very impressive. And Lawrence Stroll is spending a huge amount of money on that team and giving them very much what they always wanted. And I think they had a 9-day period. It was a 7 or a 9-day period in which they announced a new sponsor every day for those 7 days or 9 days. So they've had a whole portfolio of new sponsors come on board, some very impressive brands. Of course, Lawrence's epic business network will be helping. He's a proper, you know, entrepreneur to be owning a team. So they have new sponsors. They have there's a feeling of optimism around that team. But as you say, are things going to be that much different? Let's hope that they do make a step forward this year. But as I see it, the big danger for Aston Martin, it just reminded me of Jaguar Racing. You know, the whole massive. But reminded me insofar as a brilliantly executed rebranding. You know, Aston Martin writ large across Formula One, you know, the green, that Daniel Craig's there, James Bond's there, they've got, you know, it's absolutely great. In Formula One, you've got to walk the walk, you know, you've got to go out and deliver. And I mean, and I say that as someone who spent most of my career in marketing and the commercial side of Formula One, I can see the
style over substance.
In all seriousness, that's what, you know, having that experience does put you off a mind as to what is important. And what's important are the results. And I mean, it used to annoy me intensely that Gary Anderson or Mike Gascoigne would say, no, you can't have a car for the photo shoot because, you know, that day we're going to be finishing fettling the car before we take it to the checkdown test. And, you know, the racing always came first. But it should come first. You know, the racing is what's important. And so when you get told you can have the car from 3 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock in the morning to have a photo shoot done the night before the shakedown, that's because the team are focused on the thing that's most important, which is getting the racing bit right. Now, in the case of Aston Martin F1, they have some very capable people in that team, as we know. I'm going to mention the two Andys again, just because they've been there since the beginning, Andy Stevenson and Green. I think there are a couple of things, comments that I'd make about Aston Martin Formula One. Lawrence Stroll is there to win. He's put a lot of money behind the Aston Martin car company. He's putting a lot of money behind the Aston Martin Formula One team. He has his son there as well, and he feels his son there is there on merit, given that he invested so much in his career. He wants results, and it'll be interesting to see how he responds if the results don't come, because the management at Aston Martin Formula One, again, a little bit like the Sergio Perez story, be careful what you wish for. So they've now got everything they wished for. They've got the big brand, they've got the sponsors, they've got the investor, they've got the money paid. There's no excuses. They've got to step up, because when the phone call comes in from Lawrence Stroll on a Sunday night after the race to say, what the heck happened this weekend? You know, the fact that one car didn't get into, you know, Q3, or the fact that, you know, both cars finished outside the top six, or whatever it happens to be, the pressure will be there, and it will. The whole team needs to step forward, and there is a question about this ability to move from being the challenger team, to move from being the underdog, to move from being the little guy trying to beat the big guy, to becoming the big guy, to becoming the challenger. And in any sport, that's the case. You guys will have lots of examples. In other sports, I'm a bit mono. I tend to only follow Formula One. But in other sports, there'd be lots of examples where, you know, someone finally gets the big break, gets signed by the top Premiership team, or gets the opportunity to ride for the team that they always wanted to ride for on the Tour de France, and suddenly they just struggle because there's such a step. And that doesn't just apply to drivers; it applies to everyone, engineers, senior leadership team. There'll be a level of pressure ramped up. And I think they've got a little bit of a grace period this year because it is, you know, part two of these rules. But I don't feel they've got a lot of time. And I think probably in 18 months' time, you know, if we're all alive and well and doing these podcasts in 18 months' time, it'll be interesting by the time we get to the British Grand Prix in 2022 to see where Aston Martin F1 have gotten to. How did this first season go, and then how have they kicked off the new era? So I think over the next 18 months it'll be interesting to see just whether they rise to the challenge that is undoubtedly there and meet the expectation that Lawrence Stroll has of them. A couple of points about Alpine. And obviously I've written this article about the way in which Renault have rebranded the team, and there's been an upset, an unexpected departure of Cyril Abiteboul, the equally unexpected arrival of someone from motorcycle racing, where apparently they have two wheels, and a guy called David Brivio, and I don't know why they don't fall over all the time, but maybe they do.
You should see what happens when they drive a car. They think they can't fall off.
Right. Okay, so
I know. I went through the gravel trap at McLean's at Donington in a Honda Integra Type R with Aaron Slight, who is one of their Honda superbike riders once, and yeah, he attacked that corner as if he thought, yeah mate, you can't fall off.
Well, all facetiousness aside, I mean, the reality is that David Brivio, who's come in from huge success, double championship, you know, two manufacturers of success in the motorcycle world championship, is a really interesting appointment. And the thing that I talk about in the article is how the chief executive of Renault group, Luca Di Meo, knows Brivio, that they actually got together working back in the days of the Yamaha MotoGP team when it was sponsored by Fiat, because Luca Di Meo was actually head of Fiat's marketing in Italy at the time, so he thought it was a really good idea for Fiat to sponsor Valentino Rossi at Yamaha. So there's a relationship that goes back 15 years. And it's going to be so interesting to see how this pans out. It's way, way too early for any of us to know how this is going to be. There's the Alonso factor. You know, how's that going to work out? I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on that, Ben. But the reality is that Alpine have this equally massive mountain to climb. Researching that feature, I came away feeling positive. I think that Luca Di Meo, again, a guy who's been given his opportunity to run the Renault group, he's made this really big decision to put the performance brand under Alpine and to say, this is the future. This is the future for us, and we're going to make something really big with Alpine. And Formula One is going to be part of that business unit. And he's very serious about it, and he's come up with this dreadful portmanteau word, the Renaultution, to rebuild Renault into this amazing company over the next few years. But actually, when you listen to him talk and articulate the plan, he's very serious about it. And if Alpine, over the course of this year and next year, aren't seen to be making significant progress, certainly in 2022, they're not seen to make a significant step under the new era, I don't think Di Meo will hold back from making pretty big changes there again and demanding it. And I think the interesting thing is how many people have said to me over the winter, you know, this guy Brivio, I mean, he comes from motorcycle racing. What's he know about Formula One? You know, the teams are much, much bigger. There's so much more complexity in Formula One, etc. Actually, I think it'll be a strength because he will come into that team with a genuinely fresh pair of eyes. He'll be looking at everything. He'll be blown away by some things that he sees. He'll be like, wow, this is amazing, you know, what they're doing. But by all accounts, he's a people person, and he will look at the dynamic within the team in Enstone. How do people interact with each other? Are they open and honest about their position, or are they fooling themselves into thinking that somehow they are a challenger team when actually they're not? They're a midfield team. So I think I have a lot of hopes for Alpine as a result, and I really hope, genuinely hope, and this is with no disrespect to Esteban Ocon, I really hope that Fernando Alonso brings with him the thing that can really give Alpine a step forward, which is a deep insight as to where they need to go with their car development and where their deficit is on the track. And that while Fernando's out there doing his amazing job that I'm sure that he will do, the lightning starts, the speed, all of the package that comes with Fernando, that will be there. I hope within that he really gives the team a sense of direction, which is then deeply helpful to them in the future. And it doesn't turn into a year of turmoil where, you know, Alonso somehow isn't quite getting what he wants from it and it all degenerates. So let's be positive and say, you know, for Alpine and with Aston Martin, that this year becomes a positive transitional year that helps them to start to achieve their ambitions when the new era begins in 2022.
I think you get the same or similar grace period with Alpine and Alonso that you mentioned with Aston Martin. I mean, Alonso came in saying basically straight away, don't worry about 21, focus on 22, use the rules reset as a chance to properly reset and take advantage of that. So I imagine in terms of him or that team scoring results, they're going to need to strike early while the car is relatively more competitive, because I don't imagine you will see much changing on that, on the A521. I think it will stay in broadly a similar spec. And other teams who, especially in a tight midfield battle, are more inclined to push on, might leave them trailing as the season goes on. I think Alonso will give them exactly what you hope he will give them. You know, he, even during the awful second stint at McLaren and the turmoil that went on during that fated Honda project, he was a great reference for the engineers. That was a consistent message coming from the team. You know, he's someone that, you know, within a lap or two, you put him in the car, you know where the weaknesses are. He's very good at, perhaps he might be the best at discerning the difference between the impact his own performance is having and what the car is doing. You know, he's very good at adapting to various engineering oddities or tricks that have been employed on cars. So, you know, he will be able to give very precise feedback. He does have a particular style, and sometimes, you know, it can be difficult maybe to reference what he does against other drivers because of his unique abilities. But there's no doubt if they pay attention to what he says, then it will give them a good direction. The pressure, I think, will come on them in 22 if the car isn't there, because if they follow what Alonso says and they throw everything at that season, if we're talking again at the 22 ahead of the 22 British Grand Prix, I think that's going to be key, how they perform in the early races of that year, and then what pressure, if performance isn't there, comes from the top in terms of where that program's at. There's a couple of things that are slightly confusing to me about the whole Aston Martin and Alpine setup, and that is, you know, Toto Wolff's been talking at Mercedes about, with the budget cap coming in, how obviously they're having to downsize, and it's the same for Red Bull, Ferrari, etc., the bigger teams, but how he's been trying to turn that into a positive, and, you know, how it helps them drive efficiency and not waste spending of money when, you know, you have the almost unlimited budget. It's not that they do, but when, you know, you have so much more money, it's easy to just throw that money at things and you don't know whether you're getting value for that spend. It seems to me, from reading your feature, Mark, that the Alpine approach is very much in similar to what Abitbol was trying to do, to attack it from an efficiency point of view. So they're a manufacturer team, but they're not trying to spend the sort of budgets that historically manufacturer teams have spent. And it seems like there's an extra drive now from the new leadership to really focus on that efficiency. And that's to be expected because of the global pandemic and everything else. So you've got a manufacturer team that's trying to do things really without spending too much money, and certainly not spending money unnecessarily. So can they really drum up enough funding to take the step that they need to take in the future? And then you've got Aston Martin, which historically has been a team that has been about efficiency because they have no choice. They haven't got the money to spend, so they have to just make the best of what they've got. And you've got an owner coming in saying, well, money's no object now. I'll spend whatever you need. But they're not a manufacturer team. They're a customer team. So you've got guys there. Suddenly the money's there, but where do they spend it? Do they know how to spend it? There was a comment from Andrew Green, I think. I'm not sure if it made it into Andrew's feature without checking, but yes, in fact, it is in there. So Lawrence comes in and he asks the team, okay, you know, what do you? I want to win. I want to be world champion. So what do we need to change? And his instinct was to say, well, there isn't really a lot I would change. But I find that odd, in the sense that, well, now you've got, you know, there's no stone unturned. So surely you must have a huge list of things you want to do that previously you've not been able to do. Or has the team just become so embedded in this culture of, we haven't got money, so we do things this way? Are they going to be able to adapt to this kind of manufacturer largesse model, if you like, but one that also doesn't quite fit with the overall model, which is, we're a customer team buying components in. They're not able to innovate in quite the same way. And Max Verstappen has talked endlessly about how, you know, when people throw the, well, you know, why don't you go to Mercedes? Why didn't you go to Mercedes line of questioning? He's like, well, you know, why don't you, what about the, you know, customer team model? He always says, well, you want to be in a different team because you're not going to go quicker than them unless you do something different. And I don't see how Aston Martin is doing anything different. So some of these things don't quite add up to me, and it will be interesting to see how it pans out. But from opposite ends of the spectrum, I think those two teams are the test cases of almost the opposite approach to each other.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point. And I think that's very much what I was alluding to in relation to Aston Martin. Can the management step up to what's now expected of them? Because, you know, if Andrew Green is saying, and if you are listening, Andrew, I hope we're not quoting you out of context, but the reality is, well, I'm talking about me quoting anything that he has said out of context. There should be a wish list. You know, what would you most like? And in order to move things forward, and it is difficult when you have spent such a long time. Effectively, the last time that Silverstone team had a big budget was 2 decades ago. you know, I'm talking about a big budget relative to the competition, was 2 decades ago. When you've spent 20 years in scarcity, literally planning, you know, we can only afford a certain amount of upgrades this year. That's the only way we can go racing. There's a danger to suddenly being given a budget that enables you to order a smorgasbord of development, because you know what do we want? What do we want? Where do we want to focus? So, from that respect, Andrew is probably being absolutely spot on to say, well, there isn't a lot we need to change at the moment. Let's just let everyone breathe a little bit. Get this baseline car, get the most out of that, and identify some key areas. And I think this is where, I'm not going to predict changes for the future, but this is why I say, come the British Grand Prix 2022, 18 months' time, if Aston Martin F1 haven't made a really big step forward, this is where you could see some changes. Because when you look at the job that Andrea Seidel has done at McLaren, and you look at the job that I fully expect Jost Capito to do at Williams, that kind of very significant transformation now needs to take place also at Aston Martin, identifying where are the weaknesses within the team, how can we build a car that, yes, it's got a customer powertrain, but, you know, Ben, you just said a few minutes ago, Daniel Ricciardo in a McLaren Mercedes might win a Grand Prix this year. Well, we should be saying that about Aston Martin F1. In fact, we should be saying it about Aston Martin F1 even more, because Daimler-Benz owns 20% of Aston Martin as a car company, and there's an incredibly close relationship there. So really, they need
They copied the old car, and they've got the new suspension, haven't they?
So there's a little bit of a shift that needs to take place there to go from being the challenger to being the winner. And that's going to be an interesting challenge. I think Alpine, I mean, I remember tweeting about it, and I think it was Andrew Benson that had a go at me about it, but I remember tweeting about it at the time that when the budget cap came out, I said, you know, the budget cap is a kind of, you know, it's a Goldilocks budget cap for Cyril Abita, Bull and Renault. You know, it's not too large and it's not too small. It's actually just about right. It's perfect for the budget cap in many respects, is designed for Enstone, and you know, that's not to say that Renault and the FIA had particularly close conversations about these things, but the fact is it is pretty suited to where Alpine are at, and I think Alpine will make a very good fist of it in terms of this budget and the new era. The thing that slightly shocked me about the Alpine launch compared to the Aston Martin launch, and again, this is me with my commercial hat on, is the lack of sponsors at Alpine. And there's not a lot of third-party sponsorship coming in there. They still have a significant deal with BP Castrol. The DP World deal seems to have fallen aside. And this is the difference between an Aston Martin owned by an entrepreneur like Lawrence Stroll, who's out there networking like crazy, getting sponsors lined up, and a Formula One team owned by a car manufacturer. Because what Alpine really need is a Formula One team, is for the chief executive of the Alpine division, which is Laurent Rossi, and Luca Di Meo, to use Renault Group's buying power to do deals with lots of companies around the world to sponsor the Formula One team. And that's where the budget can come from. And there's a key thing that they need to do. And in my feature about Alpine, I talk about the fact that one of Brivio's successes with Yamaha and with Suzuka was his ability to go to Japan and get the bosses there to give the team the resources they needed to go and do the job and to win the world championship. And I think that's kind of, without giving away everything about what's in the feature, that's one of my conclusions, is that if Brivio can get Renault Group to support Alpine's Formula One program in the way that it should, that's going to be the success. That'll be the trigger event to help them move up a couple of notches and be a contender.
One of the key things that struck me during the Alpine launch was the way their virtual set and the way that various people were composited into it looked like the character selection screen from something like Street Fighter or Killer Instinct. I kind of found myself wanting to know what Davide Brivio's special move was. You know, does he throw a fireball? Does he do a spinning kick? And those things did slightly distract me from the absence of commercial sponsors. But yeah, when we were trying to shake down Aston Martin for pictures ahead of the launch, because obviously we had a period of a few weeks where we had words but no pictures, much to the considerable chagrin of our graphic designer. Their PR guy said, I'm really sorry, we've taken pictures of our drivers, we've had to throw them away because the commercial people have done umpteen deals since then and all the sponsors, the garb is out of date, we need to make more. But we're slightly running short on time now because we've got our 10 o'clock meeting in 15 minutes, even though that 15 minutes is half past 12. It is 5 o'clock somewhere.
This is sounding like Alice in Wonderland, Codders. I don't think anyone could understand
going down
this.
That rabbit hole again. shall we very quickly, because we have something else that we need to talk about at the end, should we quickly touch on Saudi Arabia? Because obviously it promises to be the fastest street circuit in the world. It's going to snatch the crown of Baku. Very difficult to tell from a map, that even a map that Herman Tilke has drawn, how fast it's going to be, what it's actually going to be like. And also, I suppose this venue, as currently planned, is only going to host the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix once before the event moves to a purpose-built venue somewhere else. So what is our verdict on this strange mirage in the desert?
I watched the online video posted a virtual lap of the track, which looked like it had been done on a Formula One game in something that looks like an Aston Martin. So maybe they're getting ahead of the game with track
How
data.
Cognizant of you.
From that simulation, from what you can tell, it does look fast. It looks to me like it looks a bit like Singapore with those walls all the way around and the fences, but and some of the twists as well. So the straights that are not quite straights, they look very Singapore to me. But it does look Baku fast as well. You can see some of the influence of Baku, I think, which Tilke obviously also designed in there. So yeah, I think it will be quite fast. It doesn't look like it'll be very easy to overtake on, mainly because these straights that twist, it looks to me like perhaps an accident waiting to happen, because you're going to get people cutting other drivers off when they get a run, being able to use the natural contours of those walls to basically squeeze them out. It looked like it could leave a bit of a mess, but I mean, whether it claims the fastest crown or not, it remains to be seen, but it does look like the kind of layout that could, because even though the map looks quite twisty, a lot of those twists are kinks, really, so it will be very fast.
Yeah, I agree with your summary there. I think it's an interesting layout. When I first looked at it, I thought accidents. It has that feel about it. And however, I think the Saudis are going to make a real go of this Grand Prix. I was talking earlier today to a pal of mine from London who happens to be out there on business in Saudi, and he said he's been out there for some time. And he said it is literally the only topic that people are talking about. Now, this is not someone who works in Formula One. This is a British businessman. And he said it's just the number one topic. The country's really getting behind it. And when I say the country, I mean the people. You know, he was saying like the business community are fascinated by the fact that they're going to have this global sporting event in Saudi Arabia. So I think it's going to be a well-attended event. I think if you know, Formula One are looking to recoup some of their losses in terms of selling hospitality and such things, I think it'll be a sellout. So it'll, you know, whether it's a one event wonder and then moves to a permanent track or not, I think this year's event will be successful. And, you know, fair play to those involved in pulling this deal together. I spoke a couple of weeks ago to Chloe Target-Adams, who's Global Director of Race Promotion for Formula One. And, you know, she told me about the work that had gone into making the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix happen. And it's a big win for Formula, you know, whatever people think of the ethics of going to Saudi Arabia. And I've had a little bit of hate mail over my column in the magazine a couple of months back. fence-sitting to say, you know, we should go there and use the platform of Formula One to talk about, you know, human rights and issues like that. But the fact of the matter is, from a sporting perspective, it's good news for Formula One to have a new country and have a new venue. And to have the track send out such detail of how the venue is going to be at this stage is also encouraging. So it shows they're not sitting on their hands. They're really cracking on with it. So let's see how it pans out. But whatever happens, we know we're going to be racing in Saudi Arabia for at least 10 years. So we may as well get used to it.
So we will see if we actually get to go, if we get to attend any Grand Prix this year. That's very much a work in progress. Now, we're about over the hour now, so it's time for the Shepherd's Crook to more or less come and drag us off screen and off the internet. But we can't really go without paying tribute to the late, great Murray Walker. And it was a very sad piece of news we received just as we were closing this issue of GP Racing for press that Murray had passed away at the ripe old age of 97. And of course, as well as being a pioneering broadcaster, someone whose enthusiasm has motivated and enthused and excited many people, really got them into Formula One and other forms of motor racing. He was a great friend of GP Racing. He's appeared on our cover and he wrote a monthly column for us until the age of 92. And it was a very sad day when he rang up and Anthony Rowlandson answered the phone and Murray said, I think I'm going to have to give up because I'm just finding writing too hard. I think I've run out of things to write about. And just digesting that sentiment was huge for us because Murray was a man who was never lost for words. So the thought that he'd found himself temporarily bereft was quite staggering to us. That and the fact that he was finally hanging up his typewriter. So yeah, it was a very sad day, and another sad day followed this last week. And Mark, you're going to be writing a nice big tribute to Murray, which has been embiggened over the past couple of days, because I think we're going up a size in pages next month. So we've given you a couple more, and so we'll be having a Murray-a-thon.
Yeah, that's quite a challenge, because how do you follow all the tributes that have already been written? And I think my comment on the whole thing is that in terms of the tributes, is that it's really interesting to see people like Adam Cooper in Autosport magazine and David Tremaine on the Formula One website, journalists and, you know, media commentators who've been around the sport for many decades, writing very heartfelt tributes. Murray affected everyone in the sport. He enthused everyone in the sport. There are many people in Formula One today working in Formula One, I have to say myself included, who heard his voice when we were children, and it motivated us to follow motorsport. And to take your point, Stuart, it wasn't even necessarily in Formula One in my case. It was actually listening to him commentating on British touring cars and rallycross. And it was rallycross with the likes of John Button, Jensen's father, and Will Gollop in a Saab, and Martin Shanker in a Ford Escort. You know, that's what I remember. Murray Walker commentating with great enthusiasm from Lyddon Hill and such places, you know, back in the 70s, made for television motorsport that rallycross was. And then to see him come through into Formula One in 1978, starting to cover it full time, and then, of course, famously joined by James Hunt, who I was also lucky to meet and work with through the Marlboro World Championship team program. And then obviously I got to know Murray, as we all did, you know, once we broke through into Formula One. And so he's had such a massive effect on our sport, a massive impact on our sport, the ultimate ambassador. He sometimes was criticized for being nice about everyone, but he was nice about every driver and team because he actually appreciated the challenge of competing in Formula One. And whether you were the last driver on the grid or on pole position, he appreciated the effort that you were putting in. And that really came across because he just loved the sport. He was an enthusiast about the sport of Formula One and motorsport generally. And of course, the other thing is that, you know, when I come to write the piece, I'm going to be reflecting on the overall makeup that was Murray Walker, because he wasn't just a commentator, he was a competitor. And, you know, we think of Murray, I used to think of Murray as as a commentator, but he's a commentator of the ilk of a Martin Brundle. He's been and he's competed. He's actually raced, now, albeit it was on two wheels. And I remember not long after he retired, he had his last race at the United States Grand Prix in 2001. And not long afterwards, there was a gala dinner in London. So the evening was supposed to be all about Murray Walker, but he had Giacomo Agostini and John Surtees on stage with him, two famous multiple motorcycle world champions. And Murray made the interview all about them. And they ended up talking about their careers, not Murray's career. And, you know, he was just passionate about two wheels, four wheels. He loved what he did. The famous partnership with James Hunt is one that I think a couple of generations of Formula One fans remember so fondly. But just a final point, given that I'm doing the podcast again this month from Australia. Down here in Australia, there was a massive response to the news about Murray Walker's passing. And again, I think from a British perspective, it was all too easy to forget that he wasn't just the voice of Formula One in the UK. He was the voice of Formula One for the BBC, which at that time syndicated the coverage to places like Canada and Singapore and Hong Kong and Australia. And I remember Murray telling me that when he wrote his autobiography, he came here to Australia to do a book tour. And they had to do a reprint. I mean, they sold out all the books in Australia within a couple of days. And he just loved it. He loved it down here. And he was super famous. And whenever we used to turn up for the Melbourne Grand Prix to kick off the season, when Murray was a commentator, you will both know that outside of the paddock, you've got the outside the turnstiles, there's an area where the fans can stand quite close to the turnstiles. And of course, they wait for all the drivers coming in. Murray would be there for 45 minutes signing autographs. He'd have, you know, people just going nuts. And this was a guy, you know, already in his 70s and, you know, amazing. So really a huge loss. I'm looking forward to writing the piece. I hope I do some justice to him and I appreciate the opportunity.
What really struck me, I mean, I missed the Hunt era with Murray in Formula One. And so I suppose his combination with Brundle is a bit more, you know, my era after, you know, some fill-ins by Jonathan Palmer, etc. And the thing that really struck me, apart from obviously, you know, just the quality of his voice and the enthusiasm of his commentaries, it's just the humility, really. I think, you know, it's interesting that you talk about him, you know, being on stage for an evening about himself, being at Formula One events and signing autographs for 45 minutes. Despite this obvious fame, he never made things about him, and it reflected in his commentary as well. And I was struck by a clip I saw on Twitter, as you do periodically, from a race from the Australian Grand Prix of 97, and Heinz Harald Frentzen is in the Williams, and he's chasing down, I think, David Coulthard in the McLaren in the late stages, and he goes off at the first corner, and Murray, in his typical, you know, flourish, goes on, you know, ramps up the excitement. Frentzen's gone off, and a huge dramatic event, and he starts talking about how, you know, this is indicative of Frentzen's reputation. When the pressure's on, he can't quite hack it, and he tends to make mistakes, etc., etc. And then it becomes clear after a few replays that the car's brakes have failed, and that's the reason that Heinz Harald has pitched himself into the gravel trap at turn one. It's nothing to do with his mental state and chasing down his first Grand Prix victory. And Murray just switches tone and just delivers the most unreserved, solemn apology to Heinz Harald Frentzen for for staining his character in this way, and I just—it's just brilliant. It's you can't take your ears off it. It's just wonderful to hear, and I think that clip summed up the humility of Murray Walker's commentary. And it obviously, you know, in fact, it was the way he carried himself in life generally, and it's probably a key part of why he was so popular. Just—I mean, I never knew him, I never met him, but obviously, he was a big part of my childhood growing up as a Formula One fan, and it just seems like he was a lovely bloke too. So. Yeah, great to see such an outpouring of emotion and fondness for everything Murray did for Formula One.
So can we have a very quick editorial decision then? When I write this article about Murray, can I tell the extraordinarily salacious story he told me about James Hunt, which he promised me never to repeat? He said, until I'm gone.
Oh, yeah. Do it.
Stop, please.
Do it. You can't live all the dead. So please
yeah.
do it.
Yeah, so it's...
fabulous.
Yeah, so that one, I've got that one up my sleeve. I have to think of the appropriate terminology and words to use to describe the particular incident. But anyway,
wonderful.
Ye gods, in the words of Nigel Roman. Extraordinary scenes. And yet, Murray, a guy who was a lovely chap in real life as well as on screen. You know, so often they say you should never meet your heroes. Very often, famous people you look up to, you meet them, and quite frankly, you wouldn't let a panda mark its territory on them if they're on fire. And Murray, just a really, really nice chap. And certainly when I started in Formula One, unlike the vast majority of other people in the media, he was not gatekeepery about it. He was actively welcoming. It was like homing in on a new face, saying, "Oh, who are you? Welcome aboard. Hello, I'm Murray. I know who you are. Dear Lord, I'm not that daft." And so, yeah, a lovely, lovely chap. And he'd remember who you were if he met you a couple of years later, having not seen you in the interim. He would remember your name and what publication he worked for. I know he was famous for his gaffes on screen, but that was just, I'm sure, just because he had lots of people in his ear and processing all that stuff in his brain. His brain must have been like the equivalent of that huge warehouse at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they deposit the Ark of the Covenant and the camera pans back and you see this vast warehouse full of boxes. You know, he just knew so much. And sometimes there was a little bit of a lag while he sent someone down there to crowbar open a box with a gem of knowledge in. So, yeah. A lovely chap. On that valedictory note, time for us to go off to our meeting, because I think our managing editor is going to be saying, "Where are they?" So thank you, Mark. You can go to bed now.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go and have a cup of hot chocolate or something. Actually, I'll probably have another beer. Maybe not.
Yes, another Heineken Zero.
There are something a bit stronger.
Other brands are available.
Thank you, Ben. You can go and have some medication to get rid of toddler lurgy.
Yeah, some hot water with lemon and a rest for my voice, I think. Thank you, Codders.
And thank you all for listening. Check out gpracing.com for our latest subscription offers. And if you want to find out what shops we're in before you venture out, you can visit seymour.co.uk/storefinder. And you spell Seymour the same way Principal Seymour Skinner from The Simpsons spells it, or indeed Dr. Seymour Butts from The Simpsons. So yeah, that's seymour.co.uk/storefinder to find out what shelves GP Racing is on. Thank you very much. We will speak to you in just a few weeks' time. Thanks for listening.